This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present To Hell and Back, Europe, 1914 to 1949 by Ian Kershaw. Narrated by John Curlis. Preface. This is the first of two volumes on the history of Europe from 1914 to our own times. It is, by some distance, the hardest book I've undertaken. Each book I've written has in some sense been an attempt to gain a better understanding on my part of a problem in the past. In this case, the recent past contains a multiplicity of extremely complex problems. But whatever the difficulties, the temptation to try to understand better the forces that have in the recent past shaped the world of today was irresistible. There is, of course, no single way to approach a history of the 20th century in Europe. Some excellent histories with varying interpretations and structures, among them, each with a different slant on the century, the works of Eric Hobsbawm, Mark Mazower, Richard Vinon, Harold James, and Bernard Wasserstein already exist. This volume, and the one to follow it, necessarily represent a personalized approach to such a momentous century. And, like every attempt to cover a vast panorama over a lengthy time span, it has to rely heavily upon the pioneering research of others. I'm more than conscious of the fact that for practically every sentence I wrote, a plethora of specialist works, often of great quality, was available. Only for a few aspects, mainly relating to Germany between 1918 and 1945, can I claim to have carried out primary research. Elsewhere, I've had to depend upon the excellent work of other scholars in many different fields. Even with greater linguistic competence than I possess, this would have been inevitable. No single scholar could possibly carry out archival work throughout Europe, and, since invariably experts on particular countries and on specific historical themes have already done such work, the attempt would be pointless anyway. Such an overview as I am presenting has therefore to rest on the countless achievements of others. The format of the Penguin History of Europe series precludes references to the many indispensable works of historical scholarship. Monographs, editions of contemporary documentation, statistical analyses, and specialized studies of individual countries on which I have relied. The bibliography reflects some of my more important debts to other scholars. I hope they will forgive the inability to refer to their works in footnotes and will accept my deep appreciation of their great endeavors. Any originality rests therefore solely on structure and interpretation, how the history is written, and the underlying nature of the argument. The introduction, Europe's Era of Self-Destruction, lays out the framework of interpretation of this volume, as well as indicating the approach to the second volume, yet to be written. As regards the structure, I have organized the chapters that follow chronologically with thematic subdivisions. This reflects my concern to pay particular attention to precisely how the drama unfolded, and to the specific shaping of events by concentrating on fairly short periods, while necessarily dealing separately within those periods with the differing formative forces. So, there are no chapters devoted expressly to the economy, society, culture, ideology, or politics, though these find their place, if not necessarily with equal weight, within individual chapters. The first half of the 20th century, the subject of this volume, was dominated by war. This raises its own problems. How is it possible to deal with the vast and momentous topics of the First and Second World Wars within such a wide-ranging volume as this? Whole libraries of works exist on both conflicts. But readers may justifiably be expected not simply to be referred to other works, though naturally these can be followed up on every theme of the volume. So I thought it worthwhile to begin the chapters relating directly to the two world wars with extremely concise surveys of the developments on the fronts. However tersely described, largely for orientation and to highlight in the briefest terms the scale of the calamities that determined the immensity of their consequences, it's obvious that these events were crucial. In other instances, too, I pondered whether to take for granted that all readers would be well acquainted with, for example, the background to the rise of fascism in Italy, or to the course of the Spanish Civil War, before deciding that, again, brief surveys might prove useful. Throughout, I've been anxious to blend in personal experiences of contemporaries to give an indication of what it was like to live through this era, so near in time yet so different in nature to present-day Europe. Of course, I recognise that personal experience is just that. It can't be taken as statistically representative, but it can often be seen as indicative, reflective of wider attitudes and mentalities. In any case, the inclusion of personal experiences provides vivid snapshots and gives a flavour, detached from abstractions and impersonal analysis, of how people reacted to the mighty forces that were buffeting their lives. A history of Europe can't, of course, be a sum of national histories. What is at stake are the driving forces that shaped the continent as a whole, in all or at least most of its constituent parts. A general synthesis has naturally to offer a bird's eye rather than a worm's eye view. It has to generalize, not concentrate on peculiarities, though unique developments only in fact become visible through a wide lens. I've tried not to ignore any areas of Europe, and often to emphasize the specially tragic history of the eastern half of the continent. But inevitably, some countries played a greater or more baleful role than others, and correspondingly warrant more attention. Europe in this volume and the next is taken to include Russia, then the Soviet Union. It would be unthinkable to leave out such a crucial player in European history, even if extensive parts of the Russian, then Soviet Empire, lay geographically outside Europe. Similarly, Turkey is included where it was significantly involved in European affairs, though this sharply diminished after 1923, once the Ottoman Empire had broken up and the Turkish nation-state had been established. This volume begins with a brief overview of Europe on the eve of the First World War. Chapters then follow on the war itself, its immediate aftermath, the short-lived recovery in the mid-1920s, the searing impact of the Great Depression, the looming threat of another world war, the unleashing of a further great conflagration within a generation, and the devastating collapse of civilization that this Second World War produced. At this point, I interrupt the chronological structure with a thematic chapter, Chapter 9, which explores a number of long-term thematic developments that cross the short-term chronological boundaries of earlier chapters: demographic and socio-economic change, the position of the Christian churches, the stance of intellectuals, and the growth of popular entertainment. A concluding chapter returns to a chronological framework. I had thought of ending this first volume in 1945, when the actual fighting in the Second World War stopped. But though formal hostilities in Europe ceased in May of that year, continuing until August against Japan, the fateful course of the years 1945 to 49 was so plainly determined by the war itself and reactions to it that I thought it justifiable to look beyond the moment when peace officially returned to the continent. The contours of a new post-war Europe were scarcely visible in 1945. They only gradually came clearly into view. It seemed to me, therefore, appropriate to add a final chapter dealing with the immediate aftermath of the war, which not only saw a period of continuing violence, but also indelibly shaped the divided Europe that had emerged by 1949. So the first volume ends not in 1945, but in 1949. One of the most beloved clichés of football commentators when the half-time interval has brought a remarkable change of fortunes is, it's a game of two halves. It's very tempting to think of Europe's 20th century as a century of two halves, perhaps with extra time added on after 1990. This volume deals only with the first half of an extraordinary and dramatic century. This was the era in which Europe carried out two world wars, threatened the very foundations of civilization, and seemed hell-bent on self-destruction. Ian Kershaw, Manchester, November 2014. Introduction. Europe's era of self-destruction. Winston Churchill. The wars of peoples will be more terrible than those of kings. Europe's 20th century was a century of war. Two world wars followed by over 40 years of Cold War, itself the direct product of the Second World War, defined the age. It was an extraordinarily dramatic, tragic, and endlessly fascinating period, its history one of huge upheaval and astounding transformation. During the 20th century, Europe went to hell and back. The continent, which for nearly 100 years after the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, had prided itself on being the apogee of civilization, fell between 1914 and 1945 into the pit of barbarism. But a calamitous self-destructive era was followed by previously unimaginable stability and prosperity, though at the heavy price of unbridgeable political division. Thereafter, a reunified Europe, facing huge internal pressures from intensified globalization and serious external challenges, experienced increasing inbuilt tensions even before the financial crash of 2008 plunged the continent into a new, still unresolved, crisis. A second volume will explore the era after 1950. This first volume, however, looks at Europe's near self-destruction in the first half of the century, during the era of the two world wars. It explores how the dangerous forces emanating from the First World War culminated in scarcely imaginable depths of inhumanity and destruction during the second. This catastrophe, together with the unprecedented levels of genocide from which the conflict can't be separated, makes the Second World War the epicenter and determining episode of Europe's troubled history in the 20th century. The chapters that follow explore the reasons for this immeasurable catastrophe. They locate these in four interlocking major elements of comprehensive crisis, unique to these decades. 1. An explosion of ethnic racist nationalism. 2. Bitter and irreconcilable demands for territorial revisionism. 3. Acute class conflict, now given concrete focus through the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And 4. A protracted crisis of capitalism, which many observers thought was terminal. Bolshevism's triumph was a vital new component after 1917. So was the almost constant state of crisis of capitalism, alleviated for only a brief few years in the mid-1920s. The other elements had been present before 1914, though in far less acute form. None had been a primary cause of the First World War, but the new virulence of each was a crucial outcome of that war. Their lethal interaction now spawned an era of extraordinary violence, leading to a Second World War far more destructive even than the first. Worst affected from the interlinkage of the four elements were Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe, for the most part, the poorest regions of the continent. Western Europe fared better, though Spain was an important exception. The disintegration of the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires at the end of the First World War and the immense violent upheavals of the Russian Civil War that followed directly on the revolution unleashed new forces of extreme nationalism in which identity with the nation was usually defined ethnically. Nationalist and ethnic conflict was especially endemic in the poorer eastern half of the continent, the regions of long-standing ethnically mixed communities. Often nationalist hatred singled out Jews as special scapegoats for resentment and social misery. There were more Jews in Central and Eastern than Western Europe, and they were mainly less well-integrated and of a lower social class than their co-religionists in West European countries. These Central and East European regions, far more so than Germany, were the traditional heartlands of vicious antisemitism. The greater ethnic homogeneity that generally existed in Western Europe, and the fact that its nation-states had usually evolved over a lengthy period of time, meant that the tensions there, though not completely absent, were less great than to the east. The victors, and most of the neutral countries in the First World War, were moreover to be found in Western Europe. Damaged national prestige and competition for material resources, the feeding ground for aggressive ethnic nationalism, played a much greater role farther east. In the centre of the continent, Germany, the most important defeated country and the key to Europe's future peace, with borders stretching from France and Switzerland in the west to Poland and Lithuania in the east, harboured great resentment at its treatment by the victorious Allies and only temporarily quelled its revisionist ambitions. Further south and east, the ruins of the Austro-Hungarian, Russian and Ottoman empires gave birth to new nation-states, often patched together in the least propitious circumstances imaginable. It's no surprise that the nationalist and ethnic hatreds that poisoned politics should make these regions the major killing grounds of the Second World War. Nationalist conflicts and ethnic racial tensions were greatly intensified by the territorial settlement of Europe that followed the First World War. The architects of the Versailles Treaty in 1919, however good their intentions, faced insuperable problems in attempting to satisfy the territorial demands of the new countries formed out of the wreckage of the old empires. Ethnic minorities formed sizable parts of most of the new states in Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe, offering a potential base for serious political disturbance. Almost everywhere, borders were disputed, and the demands of ethnic minorities, which usually faced discrimination from the majority population, were unresolved. These Versailles border reallocations, moreover, fostered dangerously simmering resentments in countries that felt themselves unfairly treated. Although Italy had no internal ethnic divisions, apart from the largely German-speaking population of South Tyrol, annexed after the end of the war, nationalists and fascists could exploit the sense of injustice that a country on the side of the victorious powers in the First World War should be deprived of the gains it aspired to in territory that would soon be called Yugoslavia. Far more dangerous for Europe's lasting peace, the deep anger in Germany, like Italy, lacking internal ethnic divisions, at the truncation of territory after the war, and the demands for revision of the Versailles Treaty, later fed into the growing support for Nazism and outside the Reich's borders encouraged the resentment of German ethnic minorities in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and elsewhere. The shrill nationalism that emerged after the First World War gained momentum not just from ethnic rivalry, but also from class conflict. A sense of national unity could be immeasurably sharpened by a focus on supposed class enemies within and outside the nation-state. The immense economic upheaval that followed the war and the dire consequences of the slump of the 1930s greatly intensified class antagonism throughout Europe. Class conflict, frequently violent, had of course punctuated the entire industrial era. But it was made far more acute, compared with the pre-war years, by the Russian Revolution and the establishment of the Soviet Union. This provided an alternative model of society, one that had overthrown capitalism and created a dictatorship of the proletariat. Elimination of the capitalist class, expropriation by the state of the means of production, and land redistribution on a massive scale were attractive propositions after 1917 for wide sections of the impoverished masses. But the presence of Soviet communism also split the political left, fatally weakening it at the same time as it hugely strengthened extreme nationalist right-wing forces. Revitalized elements from the right could direct the violent energies of those who felt threatened by Bolshevism, in the main, the traditional propertied elites, the middle classes, and the land-holding peasantry, into new, highly aggressive political movements. Counter-revolution, like the revolutionary appeal on the left, exploited the bitterness and anxieties of class conflict. Counter-revolutionary movements gained their most widespread appeal where they were able to combine extreme nationalism with virulent anti-Bolshevism. Again, countries in Central and Eastern Europe, where the Bolshevik threat was seen to loom large, were particularly affected. But the greatest international danger arose where the combination of extreme nationalism and almost paranoid hatred of Bolshevism gave succor to the creation of mass movements on the right, which in Italy, and then later in Germany, were able to take over power in the state. When in these cases the hate-filled nationalist and anti-Bolshevik energies that had propelled the extreme right to power could be channeled into external aggression, the peace of Europe stood in great jeopardy. The fourth component, underpinning and interacting with the other three elements, was the lasting crisis of capitalism between the wars. The massive disturbance to the world economy caused by the First World War, the serious weakness of the major European economies of Britain, France, and Germany, and the reluctance of the one outstanding economic power, the USA, to engage fully with European reconstruction, spelled disaster. Europe's problems were compounded by the worldwide repercussions of the war. Japan expanded its markets in the Far East, not least in China, racked by political chaos, at the expense of the Europeans. The British Empire faced mounting political as well as economic challenges, most obviously in India, where the growth of an indigenous textile industry and consequent loss of export markets added to Britain's economic woes. And Russia effectively disappeared from the world economy in the wake of revolution and civil war. Capitalism's crisis was global, but especially damaging in Europe. The inflationary crisis of the early 1920s and the deflationary crisis of the 1930s bracketed an all too short-lived boom that proved to have been built on sand. The two phases, only briefly separated of massive economic and social dislocation, provided a climate in which both deprivation and fear of deprivation massively fueled the political extremes. Economic turmoil on its own was insufficient to produce major political upheaval. For that, The turmoil needed a crisis in the legitimacy of the state, underpinned by an existing ideological schism and deep cultural divides that exposed weakened power elites to new pressures from mass mobilization. Precisely such conditions were, however, present in many parts of Europe, especially where extreme integral nationalism, drawing on a wide-ranging sense of loss of national prestige and disappointed expectations of great power status, could foster a strong movement that drew energy from the alleged strength of the diabolical enemies it claimed to face and was in a position to challenge for power in a state with weak authority. What was needed, therefore, to engender the comprehensive political, socio-economic and ideological cultural crisis that brought Europe to the verge of self-destruction was the intermeshing of the four components of the crisis. In one degree or another, such interaction affected most European countries, even in Western Europe. But in one country, especially Germany, all four elements were present in their most extreme form, reinforcing each other with explosive effect. And when Adolf Hitler, exploiting the comprehensive crisis in masterly fashion, and with ideas of overcoming it by use of force, was able to cement his dictatorial control over the German state, the odds on general catastrophe in Europe shortened markedly. Since Germany's military as well as economic potential was so great, if temporarily diminished after the First World War, and since its revisionist claims and expansionist ambitions directly impinged upon the territorial integrity and political independence of so many other countries, the probability that Europe's crisis would end in a cataclysmic new war became increasingly high. It was no surprise that the crisis would come to a head in Central and Eastern Europe, the most destabilized parts of the continent, nor that, once war had begun, the lands in the East would turn into the theatre of the greatest destruction and grotesque inhumanity. The devastation of the Second World War plumbed new depths. The moral consequences of such a profound collapse of civilization would be felt for the rest of the century and beyond. Yet, remarkably, the Second World War, in stark contrast to the mayhem engendered by the First, paved the way for Europe's rebirth in the latter half of the century. Where the First World War had left behind a legacy of heightened ethnic, border and class conflict, together with a deep and prolonged crisis of capitalism, the Second swept away this concatenation in its very maelstrom of destruction. The Soviet Union's domination of Eastern Europe forcibly suppressed internal ethnic divisions and unrest. The immediate post-war grand-scale ethnic cleansing reshaped the map of Central and Eastern Europe. Germany's dreams of domination in Europe were extinguished in the country's total defeat, devastation, and division. There was a new readiness in Western Europe to diffuse nationalist antagonism in favour of cooperation and integration. Borders were now fixed by the presence of the new superpowers. The conversion into West European state ideologies of the earlier anti-Bolshevism that had bolstered the extreme right fostered stable conservative politics. And not least, the reformed capitalism, this time with an active lead provided by the USA, produced untold prosperity in the western half of the continent, thereby underpinning political stability. All these fundamental changes after 1945 combined to remove the matrix of crisis elements that had nearly destroyed the continent in the era of the two world wars. Crucially, the Second World War broke once and for all the system of competing European great powers struggling for mastery of the continent, which stretched back beyond Bismarck's era to the end of the Napoleonic era in 1815. In a reborn Europe, though a Europe now ideologically and politically riven, The only great powers left were the United States and the Soviet Union, glowering at each other across the Iron Curtain and presiding over the rebuilding of states and societies in their own image. There was a further vital element. Once both superpowers possessed atomic bombs, as they did by 1949, and within 4 years even more horrifically destructive hydrogen bombs, the spectre of nuclear war threatened a level of destruction that would have left the devastation of both world wars in its shadow. That concentrated minds and played its own part in creating what in 1945 seemed a highly unlikely era of peace in Europe. How these elements interwove to transform Europe, East and West, remains to be explored in the next volume. What follows in this volume is an attempt to understand how Europe sank into the abyss during the first half of such a violent, turbulent century, but then remarkably, already within 4 years of reaching rock bottom in 1945, how it began to lay the platform for astonishing recovery, for a new Europe to emerge from the ashes of the old and to embark on the road back from hell on earth. Chapter 1. On the Brink. General Stumm, in Robert Musil's The Man Without Qualities. We take pacifism very seriously, but we must get our artillery budget through. Even at the time, there were premonitions that descent into war would bring an era to an end. Best known is the sense of foreboding expressed by the British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey on the 3rd of August 1914. The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime. The German Reich Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, had a similar intimation of disaster. "I see a doom greater than human power hanging over Europe and our own people," he exclaimed. As the prospect of war loomed ever closer towards the end of July 1914. 3 years earlier, in a speech in the German parliament, the Reichstag, the German socialist August Bebel had claimed, to heated contradiction and objection, that the danger of a coming European war was mounting, and that such a war would bring catastrophe to the continent. "The Götterundämmerung of the bourgeois world is approaching," he declared. The war didn't, as Babel intimated, lead to the collapse of capitalism and the triumph of socialism, but he was prescient in foreseeing that it would usher in a new era. The American diplomat George Kennan later described the war as the great seminal catastrophe. He was right. It was certainly a catastrophe. And it inaugurated an epoch, the 30 Years' War of the 20th century, in which the continent of Europe came close to destroying itself. A golden age? The image of a glittering era of stability, prosperity, and peace, tragically swept away in the horrors to come, was what lingered, especially in the memories of the privileged classes after the First World War. The Gilded Age was how Americans came to describe the pre-war years. But the term captured the way that Europeans, too, began to think of this era. The Parisian bourgeoisie remembered La Belle Époque as the time when French culture was the envy of the world, when Paris seemed the center of civilization. The propertied classes of Berlin looked back at the Wilhelmine era as a period of wealth, security, grandeur, and the national stature that befitted the recently united Germany. Vienna, too, seemed at a pinnacle of its cultural glory, intellectual brilliance, and historic imperialist grandeur. Munich, Prague, Budapest, St. Petersburg, Moscow, and other cities across the continent shared in an efflorescence of culture. New, challenging, provocative forms of artistic expression embraced practically all forms of art, literature, music, and theatre in an explosion of bold creativity. In London, economics mattered more than culture. In the capital of a global empire, the generation after the First World War would hanker after a bygone golden age of continued economic growth, flourishing trade, and stable currencies. The great British economist John Maynard Keynes famously wrote after the war of the inhabitant of London, who could order by telephone, sipping his morning tea in bed, the various products of the whole earth in such quantity as he might see fit, and reasonably expect their early delivery upon his doorstep. This was, of course, a highly privileged perspective by an upper-middle-class man of wealth and standing in the city that was the centre of world trade. Few in the shtetlers of Eastern Europe, the impoverished countryside of southern Italy, Spain, Greece or Serbia, or among the urban masses huddled in the slums of Berlin, Vienna, Paris, St. Petersburg or London itself, would have recognised such an idyllic existence. Still, the image of a golden age wasn't merely a post-war construction. Despite Europe's internal divisions and nationalistic rivalries, all countries shared in the unimpeded movement of goods and capital as part of an interwoven global international capitalist economy. The stability that permitted economic growth itself rested on recognition of the gold standard as a sort of world currency, rooted in the dominance of the City of London. In this, the Bank of England held the key to the stability of the world economy. Invisible earnings from shipping, insurance, interest, and exports more than matched Britain's import surpluses. There had been a big increase in the supply of gold in 1897 to 98, especially from South Africa, but the Bank of England neither built up excessive gold reserves, which would have damaged other countries, nor diminished them. The economies of the USA and Germany were more dynamic, growing faster than the British economy. American dominance of the world economy at some point in the future seemed probable. But Britain still had the biggest share of global trade, though this was shrinking, and was easily the largest exporter of investment capital. Rivalry for the economic exploitation of the globe among the great powers was certainly placing increasing stress on the stability of the international capitalist economy. Down to 1914, however, the system that had been of such benefit to Europe, particularly its industrialized parts, over previous decades, was still intact. Confidence in continuous stability, prosperity, and growth was widespread. When the Great World Fair opened in Paris in 1900, it was intended to exhibit a flourishing civilization, with Europe at its heart, and to sing a loud paean of praise to progress. An age of new technology was on show. Huge machines impressed people by their power and speed. The brilliance of the Palace of Electricity, lit by 5,000 light bulbs, quite literally dazzled its visitors. 24 European nations, along with African, Asian, and Latin American countries and the United States, displayed their elaborate pavilions, visited over the next 6 months, often in awestruck admiration by no fewer than 50 million people. Eastern Europe, most notably Russia, with its 9 pavilions, enjoyed a strong presence. And the European civilizing mission featured prominently. With imperialism at its height, the lavishly exotic depictions of faraway colonial possessions conveyed an overwhelming impression of European world dominance. Commerce, prosperity, and peace seemed to offer the unlimited continuation of this dominance. The future looked bright. The optimism appeared justified. Compared with what had gone before, let alone with what was to come, the 19th century had been peaceful. There had been no general continental war in Europe since Napoleon's era had ended in 1815. War in distant Crimea between 1853 and 1856, like the brief wars that had culminated in German and Italian unification in 1871, hadn't threatened the general peace of the continent. A decade after the Great Paris Exhibition, a British writer, Norman Angell, published an international bestseller, The Great Illusion, in which he even went so far as to claim that the modern wealth flowing from commerce and a globally interwoven economy made war pointless. Many, not just in Britain, agreed. It was difficult to imagine that prosperity, peace, and stability wouldn't continue into the indefinite future, that they could be swept away so soon and so rapidly. There was, however, another far less attractive face to Europe. The social fabric was changing fast, though very unevenly across the continent. Regions of intense and rapid industrialization coexisted with great swathes of the continent that were still primarily, often almost primevally, agricultural. Around four-fifths of the working population of Serbia, Bulgaria, and Romania still earned their living from the land in 1913. Across Europe as a whole, the proportion was over two-fifths. Only in Britain did it fall to a little over a tenth. And in 1913, only in Britain, Belgium, and, more surprisingly, Switzerland, not yet even in Germany, were over two-fifths of the working population employed in industry. Most Europeans still lived in villages or small towns. Standards of living continued to improve, though they were still miserable for the majority of Europeans, whether they had joined the teeming masses seeking work in the insanitary conditions of rapidly swelling cities such as Berlin, Vienna, or St. Petersburg, or whether they still eked out a precarious existence in the countryside. Many voted with their feet and left. Poverty and lack of opportunity drove many from their homelands. Far from seeing the benefits of prosperity and civilization, millions of Europeans simply couldn't wait to get away. Emigration to the United States of America peaked in 1907, when over a million Europeans crossed the Atlantic. The big upsurge after the start of the century, increasing threefold from the previous decade, was in those escaping from Austria-Hungary, Russia, and, more than anywhere, from the impoverished south of Italy. The rapidity of social change created new political pressures that had started to threaten the established political order. Political power in Europe remained in the hands of the few in the years just before the First World War. Landed elites, old aristocratic families, sometimes intermarried with new dynasties that drew their vast wealth from industry and finance capital, still formed a governing class and military leadership in most countries. Europe was, not least, still a continent of hereditary monarchies. Only Switzerland, whose age-old confederation had adopted a modern federal republican constitution in 1848, France since 1870, and Portugal since 1910, were republics. In Austria-Hungary, Kaiser Franz Josef, who had been on the throne since 1848, at the head of a sprawling multinational Habsburg Empire of over 50 million subjects, seemed to symbolize the durability of monarchical rule. A constitutional framework of government, pluralist political parties, though elected by an extremely restrictive franchise, and a legal system nevertheless existed practically everywhere. Even the Russian autocracy had been compelled to make concessions following an attempted revolution in 1905, when Tsar Nicholas II was forced to grant powers that turned out in practice to be extremely weak to the parliament, the Duma. But large sections of the population, even in Britain, viewed as a home of parliamentary democracy, still had no political representation. Some countries did have long-established systems of universal male suffrage. In Germany, for instance, the Reich Constitution of 1871 granted all males over 25 the vote in Reichstag elections, though a highly restrictive franchise guaranteeing continued landowner dominance was retained for elections to the Parliament of Prussia, an area of Germany comprising two-thirds of the entire Reich territory. In Italy, the change to almost universal male suffrage came much later, in 1912. But women weren't allowed to vote in parliamentary elections in any European country at the turn of the 20th century. Feminist campaigns challenged this discrimination in numerous countries, though they had little success before the First World War, other than in Finland, where, despite being part of the Russian Empire, it proved possible to introduce a level of democratic change following the abortive 1905 revolution in Russia, and also in Norway. The key change, and one that elites in every country viewed as a fundamental threat to their power, had been the rise of working-class political parties and trade unions. The Second International of European Socialist Parties had been instituted in 1889 as an umbrella organization to coordinate the programmatic demands of national parties. Most of these parties remained wedded in one form or another to the revolutionary doctrine enunciated by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Their attack on the innately exploitative nature of capitalism and their propagation of a new society based upon equality and the fair distribution of wealth had obvious and growing appeal for large numbers of the poor and deprived industrial working class. Attempts by ruling elites to prescribe or suppress worker parties and the growing trade unions had failed. Workers were now organizing the defense of their interests better than ever before. The rapid expansion of trade unions reflected this. By 1914, trade unions in Britain had over 4 million members, in Germany more than 2.5 million, and in France about a million. In most European countries, socialist parties and movements of different kinds had found a voice and gained increasing support by the beginning of the century. French socialists gave up their divisions and united in 1905, declaring that they were not a party of reform, but a party of class struggle and revolution. By the eve of the First World War, the Section Française de l'Internationale Ouvrière had won 17% of the popular vote and 103 seats in the Chamber of Deputies of the French Parliament. In Germany, Bismarck's attempts to suppress social democracy had backfired spectacularly. Since 1890, under a Marxist program, the Social Democratic Party of Germany had grown into the biggest socialist movement in Europe, gaining over a million members before the war. In the 1912 election for the Reichstag, the German parliament, the Social Democrats were better supported than any other party, gaining almost a third of the seats and sending a shiver down the spine of Germany's ruling classes. In the more economically advanced parts of Europe, organized socialism, whatever the rhetoric, constrained outright militancy and channeled it into parliamentary, not revolutionary, action. Jean Jaurès in France gained a major following by advocating, despite the rhetoric of his socialist party, not revolution, but a parliamentary route to socialism. The German Social Democratic Party, though rhetorically bound to its Marxist doctrine, sought in practice to win power through the ballot box. In Britain, the Labour Party, which adopted the name in 1906, had grown out of the trade unions and reflected their pragmatic concerns for worker interests rather than any revolutionary utopianism. The Marxist message was largely ignored in favour of the non-revolutionary message that capitalism didn't need to be overthrown since it could be reformed, to the eventual benefit of the working class. State power, it was presumed, could be transformed by peaceful means to represent working class interests. Workers in much of Western, Northern and Central Europe were poor, but less outrightly impoverished and less militaristic than they had been in previous times. They had more to lose than their chains. They largely fell in line behind their reformist leaders. In less well-developed parts of the continent, the situation was different. The confrontation with the power of the state was more stark. There was little or no diffusion of power through intermediary organizations or social structures that gave citizens a stake in their state. Power was largely despotic, top-down, based heavily upon coercion, with an entrenched ruling caste, corrupt officialdom, and weak or non-existent representative institutions. Notions of the seemingly unlimited progress of civilization built on benign state authority and respect for the law, which later formed part of the sense of a lost golden age among the middle classes in Central, Northern and Western Europe, looked bizarre from the southern and eastern periphery of the continent. Strikes, riots and localized insurrections against state power and bourgeois rule increased in Catalonia and the Basque country, for example, in the first years of the 20th century. Anarchism, often involving sporadic anti-state violence, had much support among the landless laborers of Andalusia. In southern Italy, where corrupt state officials were in the pockets of the estate holders, violent rural unrest was endemic. Bands of brigands roaming the countryside blended crime with popular protest in defending peasants and landless laborers against the power of the state and big landowners. Alarm among Europe's leaders at the threat they saw from a revolutionary working class was especially acute during a big wave of industrial strikes and upheavals in 1905. In Russia, faced with a revolution that came close to toppling the Tsar, the heavy hand of state repression turned into outright counter-revolutionary violence that year, when soldiers in St. Petersburg massacred 200 workers and injured hundreds more. The revolution was suppressed. Concessions, more cosmetic than transformational, were made to parliamentary representation, but power was retained by the Tsar and his appointed ministers. To the powerless, especially to those leading the socialist movement, whatever its doctrinal divisions, it seemed obvious. Tsarist autocracy couldn't be reformed. It had to be overthrown. The result was the intensified, raw radicalism of Russian socialism. Not only in response to the perceived threat from left-wing movements, but also to help governments with little or no mass backing to widen the base of their support, populist counter-movements emerged. These were often sponsored directly or indirectly by industrialists or landholders, keen to deflect potential class-based opposition into more controllable channels. They sought to nationalize the masses, to instill in them assertive nationalist, imperialist, and racist sentiments intended to benefit the political status quo. To some extent, they were successful. Belligerent nationalism, vicious anti-Semitism, and other brands of racism were commonplace outside the minority drawn to the doctrines of international socialism. The spread of basic education, the growth of literacy and cheap popular newspapers offered the possibility of extending such influence. Mass politics was opening up to new forms of mobilization on the right as well as on the left. Old certainties were starting to dissolve. The political establishment of the old conservative and liberal elites sensed new insecurity. That mobilization of the masses could pose a serious threat to the existing political and social order had prompted the French psychologist Gustave Le Bon to publish in 1895 his analysis of mass behavior, The Crowd, a study of the popular mind, in its original version, La psychologie des foules. His claim that rationality disappeared when the individual was subjected to the irrational, emotional urges of the crowd was influential as the new century began. There were 45 reprints and 17 translations of the book, and it later became required reading for would-be fascist dictators. Across Europe, the emotional urges that Le Bon saw as characteristic of the masses could most easily be whipped up through appeals to nationalism. Europe's ruling elite didn't see nationalism as anything like as dangerous to socialism. Before the war, the dangers built into nationalist fervour were indeed containable. They laid the roots, nonetheless, of forces that would come to undermine, then ultimately destroy, the established order. Political polarization, as well as tension in foreign affairs or embroilment in external conflict, shaped relative levels of high-pitched nationalist rhetoric. Attempts in Spain to build unity around notions of national regeneration were derailed following the disastrous defeat and loss of colonies to the USA in what had initially been a popular war in 1898. These attempts were in any event doomed to failure, given the deep internal divisions, regional as well as ideological, in the country. But the crusading zeal to forge a nation reborn through struggle against internal enemies would eventually lead to catastrophic conflict. In most countries, the imagery of enemies, internal as well as external, was built into rhetoric that was reaching new levels of aggression. The mass media stirred animosities, usually intensely xenophobic and often outrightly racist, that governments were glad to encourage. The South African War of 1899-1902 gave a new boost to extreme nationalistic belligerence, dubbed jingoism in Great Britain. In Germany, the conservative government whipped up nationalist fervour in the so-called Hottentot election of 1907 to besmirch the Social Democrat opponents with alleged lack of patriotism. That the Social Democrats actually increased the size of their vote, though losing a substantial number of seats, indicates that, as in Britain, jingoism had far greater currency among the middle classes than among workers. Nationalist organisations such as the Pan-German League, the Navy League, and the German Defence League, each of them largely finding their appeal among the middle and lower middle classes, urged a more radically assertive and expansionist foreign policy. Before 1914, they remained no more than significant pressure groups, still outsiders to mainstream politics, let alone government. By now, even so, assertive nationalist ideas had permeated practically the whole of politics, beyond the socialist left. In Italy, the lingering sense of national humiliation at the calamitous defeat of colonial Italian forces, with the loss of over 5,000 Italian troops, by an Ethiopian army at Adwa in 1896, and the feeling that the country was a proletarian nation with no seat at the top table of Europe's imperialist great powers, boosted a nationalist feeling of almost religious fervour, emphasising struggle and sacrifice, and advocating a strong anti-socialist state, military power, and a more assertive foreign policy. For all the noise they made, Italian nationalists were far from representing majority opinion in a deeply divided society, and were still largely an irritant to government. Even so, nationalist pressure played its part in the decision of the Liberal government to gain a colony by invading Libya in 1911, the first war in which aerial bombardment played a part, when the Italians bombed retreating Ottoman troops from a dirigible. In Italy, as in Germany, radical nationalism was still a minority taste. Maybe without the Great War, it would have remained as such. But the seeds of later pernicious development had been sown. Nationalism was increasingly defining the nation, not by territory, but by ethnicity, by those who should be permitted to belong to it. A French nationalist, Edmond Archdeacon, for instance, proclaimed himself in the 1902 election to be a declared opponent of internationalism. As an anti-Semite, I demand that the 150,000 Jews and their lackeys